Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yo, what is going down? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the meaning!
All right, I am Austin Hayden. I like how Ryan, for people who can't see the live stream, Ryan just gave a Show Me the Meaning and then he kind of shrugged it off like he wasn't impressed with himself. I thought that was a good one. That was like a very...
I switch it up, you know, but this was just a normal, standard Show Me the Meaning.
He sped through it, though. We have some lost time to make up for. Everyone in the chat's complaining. Yeah. I know. We got to make up 10 minutes in the air, boys. Let's go.
It kind of had a little bit of some weasel energy, though. So kind of like ratty. Okay. And kind of... So, all right, what up? I'm Austin Hayden. I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Ryan.
What up, film fans?
And we got Raymond.
Hello.
And I'm actually pretty excited to talk about another superhero film. I know we've talked in the past about having Marvel fatigue, but now we're going to jump to the other biggie, which is DC, and we're going to be talking about the new The Suicide Squad, written and directed by James Gunn, starring fucking everybody, Idris Elba, Margot Robbie, John Cena, Joel Kinnaman, Sylvester Stallone, Hollow, who does a great fucking job, Viola Davis, Peter Capaldi, Daniela Melchior, and I hope I'm saying this gentleman's name because I actually fucking love him, but David Dastmalchian. And yeah, so what we'll do is
Pete Davidson.
Let's go around and do a first impressions on this. I'm assuming we've all only seen it one time. Let's talk about it in contradistinction to the last one, the first film, Suicide Squad, just really briefly. Let's not do like a big diatribe on it, but what are your impressions of this film? Just kind of brief first impressions, and what do you think of it as a sequel? In relation to the last film that didn't do so great, let's start with Raymond.
It's not really a sequel, though, right?
They're billing it as a sequel.
Yeah, it's kind of a sequel. It's a requel, folks.
Yet
another thing to add to the movie vocabulary.
Yeah.
I thought this movie was a very pleasant surprise. The first one. Its reputation precedes it. It's not very good. There's a lot of studio tinkering. And I think that James Gunn really benefited from sort of the, like, backlash to the backlash surrounding his firing from Disney. I think that Warner Brothers really wanted to kind of, like, stake their claim on him and say, like, oh, you know, not only are we gonna give James Gunn a shot, we're gonna let him do whatever the fuck he wants with this movie. And... I mean, for better or worse, I would say for better, this feels like a James Gunn movie. Like, you can draw a direct line through his Guardians of the Galaxy films all the way back to his Troma days. You know, this feels like it's his. His fingerprints are all over it, and I liked it a lot. To bring it back to the original, Austin was not a fan of that one.
I
don't know. Like you said, we don't need to get too deep into things on
but
that.
We're glad that they did a requel.
Well, the thing that I'm concerned about, well, not concerned about, I don't have a whole lot riding on any of this, but I think because the first movie was so poorly received, and this movie is still going to have some of that film's residue on it. I think we've already seen that from the poor box office performance of this one. You know, this one for like, you know, it's pretty unfair, but it's going to have to live in that first movie shadow. I think it's going to take folks a while to come around to seeing this one, but when they do, they'll probably enjoy it.
Yeah. Okay. Ryan, what about you, brother?
So I actually never saw the first one. Everyone told me that it sucked so bad and not to see it. And I was kind of already in my first wave of superhero fatigue and the trailer didn't do it any favor, so I was like, I'm gonna skip that one out. But I was working at Wisecrack at the time and we did about a million videos about it or in the world, so I feel like I saw it by just piecing it together, you know, when I would take out clips to edit it from and stuff, and everything I saw looked pretty stupid, and but you know, I can't really give it a fair assessment. However, this one, obviously is better. I mean, it objectively seems like it's better than the first one, even though, like I said, I haven't seen it, so I can't really say. But everyone seems to agree that it's better. And here's what I gave it. I broke it down because I have kind of mixed feelings about this movie. If I was to compare it, like, I gave it an A+ for action, violence, and gore. Top notch. So fucking good. I gave it an A- for vibe, momentum, tone. Just like, you know, the cool rock and roll, I don't know, feeling I get from watching a good James Gunn movie. B for comedy. Pretty funny. You know, not hysterical all the time. I think Guardians is funny. Yeah, some great laughs. Notably, when Peacemaker fucking just nonchalantly just stabs that guy a million times on the table. I mean, that's like one of the funniest things I've seen in a movie in a long time.
That whole sequence was great. Yeah.
I would say, though, that the main thing that hung me up is that I would say, so it has all the window dressing of a good movie, but then story-wise, I give it a kind of a C. I kind of really didn't care for the story. The starfish looked cool and stuff, but just it felt like it was subverting superhero movies, but then kind of also becoming just a normal, it had the plot of, to me, a pretty normal superhero movie, and it didn't really transcend the genre that much other than just kind of being cool and fun and a good time at the movies, which is all I'm really asking for. So I would say, compared to every superhero movie I've seen, I would give it this movie an A or an A+. It's top notch, one of the best. And then compared to just normal every movie, if I'm feeling bad, I would say maybe C+. But if I'm gonna be a little more generous, because I did have a good time watching it, B- overall. Okay. And compared to other movies, that's kind of my overall thought.
I was a little bewildered with this film as well. I didn't know, you know, the girl and I were like, is it a pacing thing? Like, because it felt like we're still working on that one, right? We'll see how it evolves over the episodes. We were like, is it a pacing thing? Like, you know, like the action sequences were great, and then all of a sudden there would be like a slowdown and a stop to tell a joke, and then the jokes were funny. They were really funny, but I didn't feel like they always served the momentum of the story. So I think the way that I would say this from a story perspective, to me it felt a little herky-jerky, a little disjointed, that the story didn't fit with all of the aesthetic momentum vibe. The vibe was fun. Like, Sharky, King Shark, is cute as fuck. Like, Weasel, like, was really kind of funny. You know, I really liked Ratcatcher too. I love how she was like a narcoleptic and she just kept falling asleep everywhere.
It's a cool character.
I didn't love Idris Elba for whatever reason. I didn't really care too much about Waller and, you know, the Viola Davis stuff, and it's kind of weird because you would think that someone like me who has like
some thoughts on that, but I'll bookmark them for now.
Yeah, bookmark that, please. Like, you'd think like the theme of American imperialism and American foreign policy, like those would be cool things, and I'd be like, ooh, I'd really get hitched into it, but I didn't for some reason. It just felt a little disjointed, and I don't know why. But at one point, I was like, man, I love the soundtrack to this. I love the feel of it. And then at the end of it, even if she and I were kind of like, what's going on here? I was like, but fuck, we were laughing and we were having fun. And it was like the action sequences were great. So I kind of, I'm still a little confused. I don't really know what I think, but people can make their own assessment based on what I just said. It's kind of like it confused me, but I also really did enjoy it. So yeah, in terms of like other quote superhero movies, because I don't even know if this is a superhero movie. It's something funny. I think it's really good and it's fun, and I definitely think people should see it, and I think it will have legs, and I think sequels will be good. But yeah, I just kind of I'm a little bewildered by some of it. So that was kind of my thing. So okay, we got one thing to talk about that we've got bookmarked. I've got a few things written down that I think we can kind of pull back, and then I really want to ask Ryan, we can kind of delve into this a little bit more. Why do we think maybe it is like an A+ action, A- with vibe, but then C+ with other stuff with story? We can talk about that on the other side of the recap. Let me just give a brief little synopsis here. So basically, after an ill-fated mission from Team 1 of the Suicide Squad, Team 2 of the Suicide Squad land on a beach in Corto Maltese to take down an anti-American regime. Now, in exchange for lighter sentences, the Suicide Squad perform Black Ops mission, wherein if they fail to go through with it, their heads will blow up due to an explosive device planted in them. The squad are basically tasked with taking down a secret laboratory which holds an experiment called Project Starfish. Now, a surviving member from Team 1, Rick Flagg, happens to be discovered, found at a base camp for rebel soldiers, and after accidentally gunning down many of these resistance fighters, Team 2 of the squad and the resistance fighters with Flagg team up to take down this regime. The team then capture The Thinker, the scientist in charge of Project Starfish, and Harley Quinn, a second surviving member of Team 1, ends up joining Team 2. Now, they get inside the lab, and once inside, they discover that Project Starfish is Starro the Conqueror, a giant alien starfish-looking thing that controls its victims through smaller versions of itself. The Thinker then reveals, however, that the U.S. government is actually behind Project Starfish, and the team realize that this is why they were sent there, to protect the United States' international interests. Flagg gets pissed about this and decides to whistleblow, but Peacemaker stops him, killing him in order to cover up America's involvement. Meanwhile, Polka Dot Man sets off explosions and takes down this whole huge laboratory building, while the rest of the team fight with the Corto Maltese military outside. Peacemaker then tries to kill Ratcatcher 2 for knowing the truth about Starro, but Bloodsport shoots him and kills him before he can. Starro escapes the lab and starts wreaking havoc across the city, but the team come together and fight him off, with Harley Quinn piercing a hole in Starro's big eye center so that the city's rats can all come together and gnaw away at his optical center from the inside, ultimately bringing him down. The film then closes with the resistance fighters bringing in democratic elections and the squad being released from their sentences in exchange for their silence on America's shady dealings. And then, of course, we get a post-credit sequence where we see Weasel from Team 1, who we thought had died in the opening sequence because he couldn't swim, getting up and kind of like wandering off funnily into the jungles of Corto Maltese. And then we also see that Peacemaker is in fact still alive as well, setting up the scene for, I guess, a sequel and hopefully lots of DC money, right? All right, the end of the film. Now we got to jump into an ad. All right, but before we continue, we got to give a shout out to our sponsor of this week's episode, Storyblocks. Look, you've heard me gush about Storyblocks week after week after week, and that's because they're legit. They are the complete stock solution, providing an unlimited library of over a million plus royalty-free, high-quality video, audio, and images through cost-effective subscription plans. I use Storyblocks for my YouTube stuff. Wisecrack, we use Storyblocks for our videos. They got everything because they offer affordable subscription plans and unlimited downloads so that you can get access to all kinds of B-roll footage, sound effects, music, motion graphics, etc., etc., etc. So if you want to get access to all the goodies that Storyblocks have to offer, make sure you click the link in the description, or you can go to storyblocks.com/wisecrack. Again, click the link in the show notes or go to storyblocks.com/wisecrack to learn more about Storyblocks. Yeah, now back to the show. All right, so now before we jump into this, I also want to give a reminder that we have a new Twitter account, so you can follow us, not just the Wisecrack Twitter, but actually the Show Me the Meaning Twitter. It's SMTM_pod. That's SMTM_POD. Go ahead and give us a follow. We're tweeting out extra stuff, comments. You can also find Ryan and Raymond and myself on Twitter as well. That's probably where I'm most active, so like I think we're going to be talking about the show and any ideas and shit like that, plus you get all of our other zany shit and things like that. But yeah, so SMTM_pod. All right, let's start peeling this back. Let's start first with Ryan. Why do you think there was a little bit of like a disjoint there? Like what happens when a film gets an A in action, an A in vibe, but like a C in story? Like what's going on there? Is it that the story... That one isn't serving the other? Like, the vibe isn't pushing the story forward? Like, it just seems arbitrary? Like, it doesn't fit together? Is that the idea?
No, I think James Gunn is such a good cinematic director, just in terms of how he was moving the camera, how he treats the characters and stuff, and, you know, the like we're talking about, the tone, the delivery of the jokes and whatnot, and the performances, you know, he's clearly, and I think he does a million takes like David Fincher, so I think that he's definitely knows what he wants and is,
yeah,
and you can tell in the movie that it's really well put together. But it's like just that, just like in all these superhero movies, that's my, the story ends up being so frivolous, and when it really, you really break it down, it's just defeat bad guy, blah, 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 and it's not really, that I never even remember what a lot of these movies are about if you were to quiz me a week after I saw them, you know?
Yeah.
To me, the best example of a superhero movie, you know, with a story that I care about, which is, you know, the classic one, and is Dark Knight, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm so brave for saying that. But the story is amazing, you know what I mean? Like, and it's a character-based story, obviously, you know, between Joker and Batman and stuff. And there's just a lot to gnaw on ideologically and whatever. And to me, that's like the template for not, you know, it's firing on every other cylinder, but also the story just has so much to munch on. Whereas this, it's like, to me, the American imperialism thing felt so tacked on, and it's like, and it's something that I've seen before. It's like, okay, America, bad. Ooh, wow, you're really telling me something, James Gunn, in the middle of this zany, trauma-esque, super crazy, big-budget superhero movie. Like, I thought that was kind of like cheap, just like, oh, you know, yeah, this isn't just a frivolous film. We're actually making a commentary if you really dig deep. But really, are they? I don't know. Like, it didn't feel important to me. That's just maybe me.
Do you think that because it doesn't feel important, do you think that somehow it takes away from maybe what could have been an important commentary? And that you kind of just, like, that because there was that, like, disjoint, that you're kind of like, oh, it kind of like I don't really buy the commentary? Or does it kind of do the opposite, where you're kind of like, oh, how clever that we can make, like, a lighthearted, kind of zany, funny, head-blowing up, kind of film, and it also just so happens to have a kind of heady and heavy social commentary as well.
No, I go the first one.
The first
one. To me,
one,
it makes
yeah.
it less. It's like you enjoy so much about this movie that to when, you know, when it comes down to, oh, and here's the big twist, or here's the story, here's the, you know, here's what you're saying, or the commentary or whatever, it just kind of felt like, oh, that's what this is, you know, okay. It felt like they were kind of trying to tack it on to me, to be perfectly honest. It didn't feel earned. It kind of just felt like, you know, it almost like they were kind of trying to go with a trend almost. It's like, so I don't know. That's just me.
Yeah. Raymond, what do you think, dude?
I actually quite like that. This will probably come as no surprise to most people, but it is it is very, very weird to see a big... We talked about this in Judas and the Black Messiah as well. It's very weird to see a big-budget studio production just not even... Like, honestly, this movie has a more clear-eyed perspective on America's antagonistic and oppressive relationship with Central America than most, like, quote-unquote serious movies do. And I don't really think it necessarily detracts from the plot. I mean, you brought up The Dark Knight. There's a similar sort of plot thread in that one with the post-Patriot Act surveillance operation that Morgan Freeman is saying he doesn't want to be a part of, and that Batman is kind of pressuring him into helping him, into using that to help him find the Joker. And I mean, all that stuff was like very, very pointedly taking aim at the Bush administration at the time. I don't see that much of a difference between the sort of political commentary in this movie versus that movie. You might say they both feel tacked on, but there is, like, you know, they go to this island for a reason. There is an animating principle undergirding both what the Suicide Squad is doing and what Amanda Waller is sending them there covertly to do. And, it takes kind of the same shape that covert operations do in places like, you know, Bolivia and Venezuela and Cuba, which is this, like, a very clear allegory for in this movie. So I don't know. That didn't detract from the movie for me. That said, I can see how some folks would watch this and maybe feel like that rubs them the wrong way. But I think it is part and parcel with, like, having a character like Peacemaker, who is so obviously, like, the living embodiment of American fascism. I think it's more integrated into the plot of the film than you may be giving it credit for.
I'm glad that you brought up Peacemaker, because to be honest, I loved his whole arc. And in terms of a commentary, I was super into the commentary of what they were going for with Peacemaker, which is actually very similar to The Dark Knight. You know, it's like, do we tell the populace, you know, what's actually going on, or do we protect them? And, you know, if the legend is better than the truth, print the legend, kind of thing, you know, like, So I love Peacemaker's part, and to me that actually did have some meat to the bone. And I'm not against political, you know, I'm not against them taking these social commentaries, you know, and putting them into these frivolous movies. It's just the effectiveness of it. I got way more out of the Dark Knight, you know, thing, because it's about Batman, the main character of our movie, using a fascist tactic, and are we on board with that, you know, and or not? That's cool to me. And then Peacemaker kind of took that mantle here. He's basically presented it as a good guy in the movie. He is a good guy, but he's doing, or is he? I don't know. That's the whole point of the movie. No. Okay. He's presented as like I read an interview. James Gunn is like, look, this, you know, he's not like an evil guy. He's just doing these evil things in the name of good, which is his whole character.
He's doing
you know,
something he believes in. He's the hero of his own story, but he is unequivocally portrayed as a villain in this film.
Okay. Yeah, you articulated it better than me. Yeah, and so I thought that was a very interesting dynamic. But the whole, but the rest of it with Viola Davis and just kind of America writ large's role in the world, it was cool that they went, you know, at least we're trying to do something, I guess. But yeah, like I said, for me, didn't feel, you know, I didn't really get much out of it.
Okay, and then let's kick it back to Raymond in a second here, because he said that he wanted to bookmark the Viola Davis thing. It's interesting then at the end of the film, the truth doesn't get revealed, right? Rick Flagg wants to reveal the truth and be like, hey, look at what America's doing, intervening in these anti-democratic actions, but they claim to be the bastions of light and freedom and democracy in the world. So he wants to be the whistleblower. He gets killed, and then the squad decide to say, hey, in exchange for our freedom, we'll keep things covered up, right? So are they really quote-unquote good guys? In a way, they do allow for the resistance fighters in that country to bring in their own democratic elections, which is great, but they do it in preserving the secrets, which then seems to imply that somehow the United States is still going to be able to maintain their back channel operations down the road.
The deep
right?
state lives to kill another day.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So
things are fucked.
No, I do think, and you mentioned Rick Flagg. I do want to say that compared to the first one, I think James Gunn has a much better idea of how to use that character in this film. I think in the first one, he's just kind of like, he's just kind of a tackling dummy. He's just sort of there to be Amanda's eyes and ears on the ground. And, you know, I don't really remember a whole lot of that movie, but I know he was entwined with what's-her-name, Enchantress. So there was some kind of, like, I don't know, goofy romantic subplot. I can't really remember it all that well, but I do remember thinking he was just sort of a generic haircut in that. Whereas in this one, I think he's pretty fun. He gets to play not just the straight man role, but you can also tell that in the years between the first movie and this movie, if this is in fact a sequel, however you want to define it, he has kind of like been infected a little bit by the people that he's constantly having to play chaperone to, that some of their, you know, not necessarily ideology, but their recklessness has rubbed off on him. There's that great line at the beginning when they're storming the beach where he's looking at the weasel and he goes, we think he's agreed to this. Like, if there is like some acknowledgement that he is, you know, the human in a comic book movie, or he's the human on a team of superheroes. And I think the first movie kind of loses track of that, where it's playing it so kind of like, just they're trying to be dark and gritty, and it's all trying to be so grounded. I'm like, you've got a fucking walking crocodile on your team. Like, you should have some fun with this goddamn movie.
Shark.
This movie is weirdly like not just a sort of reassembling of the first team, but it also is kind of a reassembly of the Guardians of the Galaxy. Like the characters in this one map, not necessarily one-to-one onto all the characters from Guardians of the Galaxy, but they have a similar team dynamic, and I think obviously, you know, James Gunn's DNA may have a lot to do with that. But to bring it back to the Amanda Waller thing that you were asking me about, I do like that, as opposed to the first movie where she is, the movie treats her as this smooth operator who's always 10 steps ahead of the game, and she's, you know, this this chess master who knows how to play all these people off of each other. Like, this movie just openly acknowledges that she's completely fucking incompetent. And so much so.
Yeah, even the rest of her team, the rest of her team are like looking at her like, what the fuck are you doing? What? Until they finally, they stage a little mini coup inside the office.
And then by the end of the movie, after she's been knocked out by her team, she gets on the comm and says to Idris Elba, she goes, I told you I'd make a leader out of you. And you're just like, bitch, yeah, you were asleep on the floor for the entire movie. But it's just one of those things that's like, I remember in the what was the last J.J. Abrams Star Wars movie? What's that one called? The Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah.
There's a scene in that where I can't. That movie's fucking terrible. But when there's a scene where the plot sort of convenes on what's his name? Emperor Palpatine. And he goes, you're both here, and you're going to try and kill me, just as I planned. And I was like, really? That's your fucking plan? And there is something interesting to that character that the Star Wars movies never acknowledge, which is that, like, anything at all, anything that happens, he could just say, like, oh, this is all part of the plan. I want you to kill me. Go ahead and do it. Do it. And Amanda Waller is like that same archetype where she's trying to do the thing where, oh no, this was all part of my plan. But because they show you so much behind the scenes in this, there's a great dramatic irony in this movie where it's like, oh yeah, all these like chess masters who are, you know, pulling the strings behind the scenes, they're all just fucking clueless. And I really liked that dimension of this movie, that it just treats her like a complete and total idiot. And all she can do by the end of it, her entire objective in the final moments of the film, is just to save face in front of the criminals that she has tried to send to their death, which I kind of like. I think that's an interesting dimension.
And to that point too, like, you know, we've been talking a lot about the political angle and stuff, which is, you know, part of the movie, but like I do love, if I, you know, I do like how James Gunn takes these misfits or anti-heroes and stuff, and when this is like the most anti-hero superhero film ever, and, you know, and it's like trying to find the goodness in everybody, right?
Yeah.
And they and I love how the last shot is him, is what, Idris with the Deadbolt with the rat. Wait, is his name Deadbolt?
Bloodsport.
Is that a different guy? Whatever. Him with the rat. So it's like, and then the thing with the daughter is cool too. Oh shit. If you guys can hear me right now, just so you know, I've my headphones stopped working for 2 more minutes. I'm sorry, but you can hear
me. No, we can hear you great.
Anyway,
yeah.
So long story short, I think that he does that dynamic so well, that tone of just fucked up people being, you know, doing, you know, finding the sweetness in it, and so that was nice and stuff. And I wish that it had kind of been more about that. The plot even had been more about that. But whatever.
So Wally in the chat actually said, you know, that it was about the hidden bits of humanity in people, that that's what this film was about. And I mean, obviously, there are always multidimensional layers in any story, right? So you can pick and choose elements. And I think the bits about the friendship between King Shark and Ratcatcher 2, right? Idris Elba kind of like overcoming his fear and disgust of a rat, which is sometimes viewed as like, you know, they've been ostracized in the animal kingdom. They've been scapegoated, right, for being the carriers of plague and stuff like that, and they are in trash cans, so rats are kind of like lowly. And then there's that scene with Taika Waititi, who kind of talks about, I mean, he kind of uses this great chain of being type of logic where it's like everything serves its purpose in the great ecological wheel of history and entities living together, and the rats serve their purpose just like we all serve our purpose, and we just have to find kind of our way to fit in the world. And whether that's an interesting idea or an insufficient idea is kind of besides the point, because I think what he's definitely trying to do is like finding that fit. How do you get these misfits together? How does King Shark, this shark that wants to eat people, how does he suspend his impulses and become friends and have this really kind of sweet, cute friendship with Ratcatcher? And then, you know, he finds the little fishies and he's like, oh, you know, I'm friends, you know, and he's just kind of like this thing, just wants to be friendly. And then they start like biting his face and shit. You know, yeah. And he loves the bird. And so there is a little bit about like what we could call the humanity or the kindness, maybe, because King Shark isn't really a human. And so, yeah, there is something about that I think is kind of sweet and interesting that this film also weaves together. right? I don't think
you mentioned.
Yeah, go ahead, Renan.
Oh, I was just going to say, you mentioned that scene with Taika Waititi where he essentially delivers that thesis statement where he says, you know, if you can find the paraphrasing, but if you can find the beauty in the lowliest of all creatures, then you can find the humanity, the beauty, whatever in anything. And I think that is, you know, that may feel, I'm sure there are some folks who would say that notion or that line would ring hollow in a movie like this, where they have, like you said, Ryan, they have a scene where a guy just walks by a dude jabbing him as many times as he can with
an animal.
But within
justice and peace.
Yeah, within the context of that moment, I remember when they cut back to Ratcatcher 2 and she's kind of holding her little rat wand and all of the vermin are scurrying out to bring down the Starro the Conqueror. There is, like, I think a real kind of, it may be an affected earnestness, but it is quite earnest. I liked those moments.
Me too.
Oh, and a shout out to Google user in the chat who says, rats are amazing. As a pet rat owner, it's so heartwarming to see them shown in a good light. I would agree. I had a friend when I lived in New York who had a pet rat, and it was the sweetest little thing I've ever pet in my life. I take that back. I've met a lot of good dogs, but it was a very great rat. Sorry, go ahead.
Also, Google user said, Rick Flagg is so damn handsome. I mean, yeah, Joel Kinnaman is a beautiful man. Beautiful,
kind of an
man.
Austin Hayden type, if I.
I mean, God bless you. So. God bless you for saying that. I appreciate you. No, this is what I wanted to talk about. Okay, so there's something interesting that we're starting to see a little bit of, and we have tiptoed around it a little bit, but we haven't really addressed it. And I think maybe we could call it the return of the auteur. And one of the things that we often complain about is that the studio gets its hands on everything and you don't really see the fingerprints of the creative on the thing, right? So many people are like, oh, is Chloe Zhao's superhero film, is it going to be an expression of her, or is the studio going to kind of flatten it out a little bit? Maybe one of the reasons that this film was successful, whereas the last one was not, and maybe one of the things that we can kind of say, the reason that the Guardians of the Galaxy films were so successful, while maybe some of the other films within that universe are a little bit kind of flattened out, is precisely because the studio stepped back and said, James Gunn, do your thing. Do your James Gunn thing. And that's why it has a distinctive vibe. That's why it has a distinctive flow, right? That's why we're all kind of like, yeah, it kind of is kind of Guardians of the Galaxy-esque in a lot of ways. So do we think that we can say that James Gunn is an auteur, even though people love to talk about like new wave cinema, like that's what an auteur is. It has to be some art house thing. Can you do big budget box office blockbuster types of films and have them be within auteur, the auteur theory world? And is James Gunn then an auteur?
The answer to both of those is fuck yes, yep. And fuck yes, Austin. you can absolutely make, you know, there's only a handful, and I really, to me, you know, in terms of is cinema dying, to me, I think that there needs to be more filmmakers like James Gunn that are like the rock stars that are bringing you to the theater just to see the director, you know, just to see whatever, like, and basically we only have a couple of those that actually can, you can bank on a drive in a film's box office, which is Quentin Tarantino, Chris Nolan, probably Martin Scorsese, you know, and then, and they all kind of, to me, make like populist art house cinema in a weird way, if you want to call it that. And James Gunn is like a little bit more of the schlocky version of that, but I love it. And honestly, I think that that's probably more popular than, demonstrably is, you know, with the box office receipts. So yeah, I think there needs to be more people that, we need to bring back like how John Carpenter used to do and put his name above the fucking marquee. John Carpenter's Halloween, John Carpenter's Big Trouble in Little China, because we need that kind of stuff to make it literally an auteur-driven market, to where you're wanting to go to a movie because of who directed it, which is so rare that anyone gives a shit. You know, it's usually the actor or just because it's some piece of IP that you've already seen. And my other strategy, which I think I used to be against Quentin Tarantino's I'm gonna retire after one more movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Strategy. I was like, who are you? You fucking, you know, why are you going to do that? Like, old people can make good movies too. Scorsese and William Friedkin, they're all doing great stuff. But I now think he's a genius for it. And I think that every good director should announce their immediate retirement this year. Okay. And then what that will do is have this effect of going, well, shit, all the good directors are gone. But then, you know, in a couple of years, they, each one of them comes out of retirement for just one movie. So it's like the Rolling Stones. You're like, I got to go see the next Steven Soderbergh movie because it might be the last one I get to see at the theater. But otherwise, because he promised he was going to retire. And then the next time he comes out of retirement every 2 years, you know, like he's already doing. And then we get people back in the cinemas again. What do you guys think about my insane evil plan to get people back into the movies?
Soderbergh is a great example to bring up because he's, you know, as you said, he at least once he formally stated he was retiring from the business.
Right.
I think Behind the Candelabra, yeah, right, he said was going to be his last feature. And I really do like the sort of approach he has had to making movies, because if you read contemporary interviews with him, he talks about how, like, yeah, I said I was going to retire and I meant it, but what I really knew in my heart of hearts was that, like, if this is how I'm going to feel about movies, then what's really the point in making them anymore? And I just had to find that spark again. And it took, you know, he went off and did a couple seasons of The Nick. He did some formal experimentation, and then he started, you know, sort of wading back into the waters, doing some iPhone movies and just, like, challenging and testing himself. I really, really like that about him. It's why I will forever respect Steven Soderbergh. He's the rare filmmaker that even on a big budget level has never lost sight of his roots. I think we talked about this a lot on the Ocean's 11 episode. But the question of is auteurism back, or is the auteur theory still valid in such a studio-driven era, Austin? I think that's definitely a much bigger conversation, but I do see examples of that in the DC universe. And I think there are examples of it in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but Marvel, I think, creatively has been a little bit of a victim of their own success, where they've got their formula locked down so much, and they get really, really gun-shy about stepping outside of that frequency.
Yeah.
Whereas I think DC, they kind of have the freedom of failure, which is that, like, so many of these movies have, you know, come out and not really connected with an audience, or even something like the first Suicide Squad made a bunch of money, but it had some real fool me once energy, as I think evidenced by this movie's box office fate. And so I can kind of feel them sort of just, like, opening things up a little bit more. James Gunn seems to have been given some creative control of this. I think one of their other best movies, or probably one of their only other good movies in this, you know, the DCEU as it's known, is David Sandberg's Shazam. I think is really, really fun, and it feels like his movie. You know, it's got some scary elements. It's like the Tom Hanks movie Big, but with a superhero. It's a lot of fun. I also think the Birds of Prey movie is really good.
And
your mileage may vary with Joker. I know that it's been memed to death, but at the very least, what I can say about that is it does at least feel like the expression of a narrative author. And so I do think they're doing their strongest work in these kind of, like, pocket continuities where, you know, the Suicide Squad doesn't really seem to have to carry the burden of, like, setting up a bunch of other movies and tying into this universe the way that every single Marvel movie seems to have to. And Shazam is just, like, out there on its own. I don't think they've mentioned that character in any of the other movies, which is, you know, kind of a surprise because he interacts with those characters in the comic books, at least to my understanding. I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of, like, you know, superhero cinema is not really my bag altogether, but it's movies like this that I'm kind of interested in. You know, I'll watch another movie like this, even if it's a failure. At least it will be a compelling and unique failure. Whereas, I don't know, when I'm kind of hit over the head with, like, the same sort of just aiming straight down the middle kind of, you know, corporate pablum that Marvel churns out, I just get tired of the same old, same old.
Oh, I was just gonna say real quick, Yash or Yash in the chat said Marvel's creatively bankrupt. So, what do we think? Yeah, Ryan, go ahead.
I I disagree with all, with kind of that and the fact that they aren't really an auteur thing, because to me it's really pleasantly surprised me the pick of directors and how much I can see the DNA, you know, their DNA in the movies. Like, you know, James Gunn is a perfect example. Sam Raimi is going to be doing the next Doctor Strange, you know, which is fucking awesome. Chloe Zhao. I mean, they're getting Taika Waititi, is now in control of Thor. And you can really see, you know, he has all these weird creatures and bizarre humor. And
so then,
you can see him in the movie.
But so is this Marvel then trying to say, oh, maybe we can let go of the reins? Like Kevin Feige, is that how you say his last name? Like we can let go of the reins a little bit and we can let these auteurs have a little bit more, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think they've been doing that for most of the MCU. I mean, I think they do a good job of making it a little fresh on almost every outing. It's more just like you said, they're a victim of their own success in the sense that it's the sheer volume and amount of them.
Yeah.
Where it's just kind of like, okay, yeah, even though this, I'm usually going to go into a Marvel movie and at the end I go, okay, that was pretty fun in some parts, you know what I mean? But it's like, it's a true fatigue. It's like there has been 20 of these 25 fucking movies. It's like all within the same kind of vibe. So even it's like they give the auteurs the reins, but then they clearly are, you know, putting the connective tissue around it that makes it a Marvel movie. And I think that is the thing that makes it to where you kind of are like, no matter how good it is, you're like, okay, all right, another Marvel movie.
Well, that's why a film like Logan was so interesting. Because Logan, to me, doesn't even feel like, is it even a part of the MCU? Like, really?
No. Well, the X-Men weren't legally allowed to be part of the MCU until Disney acquired Marvel, and now they'll probably recast and integrate those characters going forward. But all those, all the, like, Hugh Jackman Wolverine movies are totally unrelated to the Marvel movies because Fox owned the on-screen rights to the X-Men. As well as the Fantastic Four.
And so like, Logan...
There are a ton of... Yeah.
So Logan is not a Disney product?
Logan is not, no. That was, I think, one of the last... I think the very last X-Men movie that was produced under Fox was the most recent one. The Phoenix Saga. I can't remember the title of it. I didn't see it. But that was the... I think Disney actually handled the rollout for that because it was finished and then the Fox acquisition happened like... during post-production, but I could be wrong on the timeline there.
Okay, because I personally, I'd love to see more of those types of things, right? Like branch off stories of, you know, you take somebody from the Avengers, like they did with Black Widow, but give her a TV series that can be kind of like the Jessica Jonesy type of thing, right? Where you develop this character over a long time, or like The Punisher, like those series, Daredevil. Like I'm so disappointed that they canceled that series because I thought that those were so good, right? I thought that they were so interesting, and to me they felt very different than a lot of the films feel, and I don't exactly know why that is. Maybe it's because the writers have a little bit more time to develop story, character, et cetera, but it felt like qualitatively unique in that space. No?
I haven't seen any of those shows, but I know that they were being licensed. I think there's another legal arrangement where those weren't being like produced in-house at Disney. But I all that stuff was so long ago now, and there's with like the acquisition blitz from Disney over the past, you know, 10 years, I really can't say for sure, but I know that there was a different creative team who was handling the Netflix shows, and I think the reason they were canceled is because Netflix had distribution rights to those, and Disney just once they had all those characters and would have been handling production, I think they just didn't want to. They didn't want Netflix to be the ones profiting off of the content they were generating.
They want everything on Disney Plus.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, and I think that's where, once again, probably not the best person to pontificate on this, but shows like WandaVision, Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and all that stuff. I think Disney Plus seems to be the more iterative space where they're going to kind of like try those more character-oriented ideas in the long sort of series format while they start ushering in their new wave, like the second generation of Avengers, for lack of a better team name, on the big screen. But I'm kind of, yeah.
There's also another layer to this as well, that a film like The Suicide Squad is not a four-quadrant film. right?
No, absolutely not.
And all the Marvel films are.
Hard R, baby. You love it. That's one of the best parts of this movie, too.
Yeah, that's probably something that contributes to the freedom of the filmmaker, because the filmmaker is able to be a little bit edgier. And we know that James Gunn has that edgelord provocateur past, as
What kind of why he ended up at DC in the first place.
Yeah, so it allows the filmmaker to be a little bit more quote-unquote free or true to themselves, you know?
Yeah, maybe a little bit. I mean, DC also, if you go back to the sort of progenitor of the contemporary superhero movie, I think obviously the Superman movies had come out like 15, 20 years before Tim Burton's first Batman, but Batman and Batman Returns really did kind of like set the pace for superhero movies going forward until like Sam Raimi with the first Spider-Man really picked it up and kind of codified what would essentially become like the superhero genre. And those first two Batman movies are fucking like, those are Tim Burton movies. Just like,
yeah, full stop. Totally.
And I don't want to sound like there hasn't been. You mentioned Taika Waititi's Thor Ragnarok, which I think is a fun movie. The James Gunn pictures are really good in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I also think that after the first Avengers came out and made all the money, you can actually see the Marvel team relaxing a little bit. Like, Iron Man 3 is a Shane Black movie, and it's very, very good.
Oh, yeah.
I like that one a lot. And then after that was Thor the Dark World, which I wasn't too crazy about, but it does make some weird choices, and it goes to some strange places and stuff. But it still feels like they had some more creative freedom, or at the very least, they were thinking outside the box and not just trying to repeat a formula. So I do think that there has been... there have been great examples of Marvel iterating in the space in unique and interesting ways. And I just wish they would, like, if we're going to get one or two of these every year, like, just give us a few, just one of them. Make half of them give a little bit more freedom to someone who is, you know, even if it's like Iron Man 3 was never going to be a flop. So when you have a character that's that well established, maybe by the time we get to, you know, Shang-Chi 3, if that's a big hit, you can kind of take some chances and do something a little bit more risky or inventive. But who knows, you know, I've never made billions and billions of dollars making movies. So I don't know why I would listen to
me. I'm excited
to.
Not yet. Yeah. Yeah, right. All right, let's do this. Before we move on and kind of maybe delve into the mailbag here, let's go around and talk a little. Let's bring it back directly to this film, The Suicide Squad. Let's talk about some of our favorite elements, favorite characters, favorite moments. One of the things that I really love is the music. There is, during the action sequences, the kind of rock and roll feel to it all was great. I also loved that when they go into that bar and you see some of the dancers, you see Palm in as a dancer on stage, and I was like, wait a second, is that Mantis from Guardians of the Galaxy? And the fact that she had like a little quick little guest appearance, I fucking love King Shark.
What's that?
I think King Shark is just fucking adorable, and it's great that Sly is in this, but he's in the background, but he's not in the background. So I loved that, and then I thought Weasel was like hilarious. I thought the opening sequence with Weasel was great, and it made me laugh a lot. So I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we could say that we loved here. So those are like some of the little snippets that I really enjoyed. Ryan, what about you, man?
I loved Polka Dot Man. Now, that's
yeah, we haven't talked much about him. Yeah.
And to me, that is the perfect like of them example of them like transcending the genre in a way, kind of giving me something new. It's like it's reveling in the absurdity of these dumb characters and their names. You know, I love that. Yeah, especially at the beginning when we're hearing all their names, like, oh, well, his name's TDK. What's that for? And then 5 minutes later, the detachable kid. What the fuck? And his arms are off of his body. Like I want more of that. Maybe it's just because of where we are in superhero land. But yeah, like reveling in the chaos and insanity of what this is, and James Gunn's the perfect director to do that. And I thought Polka Dot Man and his whole arc, and how and the best part about it is how seriously they treated it. You know, his name's fucking Polka Dot Man. He spits out polka dots because his mom, you know, poisoned him as a child, and it's not really done with a wink and a nod necessarily. Like the guy who plays him looks very distraught and like, holy shit, like, I'm going through a lot of pain, you know, like, with these giant glowing orbs in my body. Like, I love that. And it's just up to the audience to go, this is fucking ridiculous.
I remember when David Desmalchian was in, and I may be mispronouncing that, apologies if he's listening. Come on the show if you're listening, by the way. but I remember he has a very small role in The Dark Knight. There's one point where Batman...
He's one of the escapees from whatever the fuck that place is called. I forgot the name of it. Arkham.
Yeah. And they've got him kind of pinned down, and he's kind of acting crazy and going bug-eyed and looking up at him. And I remember, even though folks didn't really know him or recognize him, he's not a household name by any means, but I remember folks on the internet, because he has such a distinctive look, and he just has such a presence about him. I remember folks on the internet talking about, like, oh, is that a setup for a villain? Is he maybe that's supposed to be Edward Nygma? Is he going to be the Riddler?
Yes, I remember that.
And it was just one of those. I remember it just being one of those moments where, like, just through sheer force of presence, a sort of day play role really, like, broke through in a major way. So kudos to him. I think he's great in this movie, and he's had quite a career since then.
Hell yeah. Another moment in the movie where I was just kind of like, wow, this is crazy. What we're watching is in the climax, whenever Harley Quinn, you know, goes through into the eye of the starfish, and then all the fucking rats are climbing up into it and then gnawing on his
like optical nerves and shit. Yeah,
it was so gross and so, like, unnerving and uncomfortable. But I was just like, dude, this is insane. Like, this is just a crazy situation. You know, when I think about it, like, logically, and how many steps it got to get here, I was like, all right, this is a pretty cool moment, and I will not forget that. I won't forget, you know? More of those moments would be good. You mentioned the music, and I agree with you 100%. Like, the music is awesome in the movie, but I can't help, maybe because I'm an editor too, it is a little cheating, I feel like, to just... You know, it's like what Martin Scorsese does in every one of his movies. It's Mick Jagger deserves a writing credit on the half of his films.
Yeah,
because
Rolling
I think
Stone
it's like...
song is the middle square on the Scorsese bingo card.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like, all right, this scene will be cool, but if I play, you know, Gimme Shelter here, it'll be 10 times cooler. And it does feel cool. And then you leave the scene going, wow, that was a cool scene. It's like, no, Gimme Shelter is just a cool song, you know, like, and you just like listening to it, to visuals. And I mean, and it works, and I'm not necessarily giving him shit for it, but it is kind of one of those things when I watch those scenes where there's just a cool, you know, mic drop, or what do you call it?
Needle drop.
Yeah. Moment. You're like, oh, right. This is cool. Here we are in the scene. It's like, all right, you know, I give James Gunn about, you know, 65% credit for that. And then whoever wrote the song, like the Pixies or something, I'm like, you know,
okay. I'll be remiss if I don't just mention this real quick as well before I kick it over to Raymond to talk about some of your favorite sequences. I really love, and maybe this would have been one of yours, but I just want to make sure we give a shout out to it. I really love the Harley Quinn scene when she's, like, taking down all those people and there's just, like, flowers shooting behind her and the animals and stuff like that. Actually, Justin Diver hit me up on Twitter and was like, what's with the Disney princess flower scene with Harley in the escape scene? Similar imagery in BOP? What's BOP? B-O-P? Birds of Prey. Similar imagery in Birds of Prey. Just being silly or seeing the fight through her eyes was the question. But yeah, I really enjoyed that aesthetically. I thought that was a lot of fun, really interesting, and yeah, just wanted to make sure we shouted that out real quick.
And real quick, Raymond, before you do your things, but with that scene in particular, my friend Greg had brought up this point. He was like, you know, if you take that scene out of the movie, it really wouldn't matter at all. In his mind, he goes, it seemed like just an excuse to get Harley Quinn in this ballroom gown for the rest of the movie, you know, was his take on it. And I was like, that's interesting, maybe, you know, yeah, because I don't know. It was a cool, aesthetically pleasing scene that, yeah, I don't know how much it added up to the final plot of the film, but anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought that was a fun sequence, and I also liked, it was a really, really stupid gag. In a movie fucking full of stupid gags, but I really loved Idris Elba riding the rubble down floor by floor by floor until he just stops face to face with Peacemaker and then shoots him through his bullet. Like, there's just you know, there's a lot of stuff like that. We were talking before about, like, is this a superhero movie? I don't really think it fucking matters, because I think this movie gets what comic books are in some ways, kind of like, kind of more than a lot of other comic book movies do. There are a lot of really great moments. I'm thinking of where the shark just grabs a person and tears them in two as, like, the lightning is striking. You just see this gory silhouette. I mean, that looks straight out of a comic book. That's really, really nifty. And I don't know. Like, we were talking in the chat beforehand about which thumbnail to use to promote this episode. I liked the posters for this. It was a kind of a fun throwback to old Men on a Suicide Mission movies. You know, your Dirty Dozens, your Wild Bunches, stuff like that. And it has this vibe that I want. Like, when I turn on a superhero movie, I want to be entertained. I want to see something that's fun and maybe a little bit outrageous, you know, not necessarily, but I like that this is embracing that kind of mandate, that it's bringing these really cartoonish ideas alive in a way that you just don't see in a lot of in a lot of Marvel movies nowadays, where it the action is not really distinctive in a lot of Marvel movies. They don't really have, you know, big iconic moments that jump into your mind. This movie doesn't have necessarily a big iconic score. I can't really remember any aspects of it, but I do think that's something in the Marvel movies that they lack as well. Is like, I would love to see both Marvel and DC kind of moving towards the things that were so distinctive about your Tim Burton Batmans and your Sam Raimi Spider-Mans, where they weren't afraid to embrace as much of the goofy stuff. Like, Marvel is really famous for every crazy comic book thing that happens in it. They kind of have to, like, wink at the audience and let them know that they're in on the joke a little bit. And I just don't think you need that. I think if you were to embrace the sort of reckless silliness that is inherent to a lot of comic books, these movies would be a lot more fun. And I think you'd find a lot more interesting and unique avenues in which to take them. You know, it's crazy to me thinking we've had 100 comic book movies in the past 10 years. And I can't think of a single one that has released posters that are made to look like a comic book cover. Like, how is that something that's never happened? You know, it's little things like that where I think these movies have become codified as a genre of movie, and they've kind of lost sight of what inspired these movies to begin with. And I think this is a notable exception to that rule, and I enjoyed it.
I think this film did a nice job of being self-aware, but not ironically detached. And so it didn't do that postmodern shtick like Deadpool does, that it really leans heavy into it, so much to the point that it's even like meta-ness enfolding in its meta-ness. And a lot of people have kind of commented that it was rated R, but cute in the chat is what they're saying. And that's it. It's because it was sincere. There was a sincerity. There was something about that. And then just the last thing we're going to say here is, before we do, just a quick little email from the mailbag. Gold Crow said, King Shark making that little bomb man, that was a great thing. And then it was like Peacemaker, because it was supposed to be Peacemaker. Really cute. That was very cute. And then, yeah, Ard was like so cute, you know, because I think everyone kind of got into that. And this was what Wally was saying earlier, that there was something about the humanity, the sweetness of relationship in this. And maybe that's why it didn't have the kind of like postmodern, dire, ironic detachment stuff that a lot of times you get in cinema nowadays that is self-aware. It was this film, it was self-aware, but without kind of falling into that irony, right?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, so what we're going to do real quick is we're just going to read an email. We got no voicemails. Mofos, give us a freaking call.
Send us voicemails.
Send us freaking voicemails. Call us. Don't be shy. We want to hear your lovely, beautiful voices. Call us at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807.
Elf Hut.
Yeah, and leave us your ramble.
Elf Hut 7.
What's that?
213 Elf Hut 7. Is that, that's the, if that helps you make it, remember it more.
Elf Hut or Elf.
That's our phone number.
Or Elf Gut. That's
Elf
right.
Elf Hut.
Yeah.
Or Elf Gut, yeah.
Or you can email us, movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. We'll just get into an email here from Will, who wants to talk about Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Hello all, my name is Will. I'm 21 years old and a college student from Dallas. What up, Will? Firstly, I want to say thanks for the great discussion on Eternal Sunshine. This was the first podcast I'd tune into ever, but I love cinema, and this is my favorite movie of all time. Got extremely lucky with the timing. I found it interesting that y'all and a few of the listeners agreed that this movie seems to hold great significance amongst teens, which is when I also watched this movie first, at 15. None of my friends seem to have the same regard, but they all watched it later than me. The message of my email is this. At one point, you discussed Kaufman's early drafts where Joel and Clem were bound to the cycle of repeating the procedure. You said it would make the movie much more tragic and negate the theme of hope, but this is exactly how I see it. In the last few seconds, the clip of them running on the beach is looped a few times, which leads me to believe that they do make the same mistakes and erase each other again and again, but are led back to each other by fate. I still find hope and inspiration in this, but I also chose to recognize the movie as a reminder of the significance of the past and understanding that our pain is what allows us to progress as humans. The themes tip slightly towards retrospection, then hope for the future. Our main characters just keep making the wrong choice. To explain this, I always thought Lacuna just continued operating without Mary or that another business had a similar procedure. Now listen, I think that this is really interesting, Will, and I'm glad you brought up that point on the beach because I noticed that as well because they're kind of jump cuts, but they're jump cuts that back up a little bit and a little bit of a rewind, and then play. And I think it happens three times. What do you think of Will's thoughts on this? And is there something significant in that final beach scene with those jump cuts that do kind of play back and forth?
I would say that I think the good email, but I think it's a stretch. I think that they kind of definitively at the end, you know, don't... I don't think there's enough evidence to say that they've done it again like this in the script.
Okay.
What do you think, Raymond?
Yeah.
Well, isn't the... I do appreciate that the ending kind of implies, at the very least, that even if they don't literally make that same mistake, that at the very least they may be doomed to make similar mistakes in their relationship as it evolves organically. But also, within the movie itself, isn't it implied that the mind-wiping company is done, that they had to fold? So I don't know. I mean, you know, who's to say they may be able to replicate the technology elsewhere, or you know, the company could find new footing, or
yeah,
or whatever.
What
I will say that even if you do read it as an indication that they will continue to do this, they'll continue to erase each other, you know, rinse and repeat. I think it is, while that has tragic implications, it's a lot more palatable than having to watch them do it over and over and over again. So that's that is, I think, the distinction there. But a really, really thoughtful email.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Will. We always get such great fucking thoughtful emails from our listeners. We love it when you email us and give us your thoughts. Give us your conspiracy theories, your spicy takes, your hot takes, your deep Reddit theories, whatever the fuck you got. Call us at 1-213-534-8807 or email us movies@wisecrack.co and follow us on Twitter at SMTM_POD. Not like the new metal band, but as in pod. All right, we love you. Where can people find you on the internet, Ryan?
Ryan Shorts. About to release, I've filmed a bunch of them lately. I'm about to release a bunch. You can find that on YouTube. Ryan's Game Show on Twitter. I'll be there in Funhouse. You can see me on some of those videos too.
Holla, and Raymond.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria. And you can also find, I mentioned this last week, but it just came out. I wrote a Wisecrack video about Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Very proud of it. Michael did a wonderful job presenting it. Amanda did a wonderful job editing it. And highly recommend if you haven't watched it already. It was a lot of fun.
It's really good. It's really good. Definitely check that out. Man. And if you want, you can find me on Twitter, Austin_Hayden, Insta, AUS_HAY, whatever, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. I write philosophy shit. I have a philosophy podcast. There's stuff out there. Ryan, send us out of here, brother.
Show me the meaning of being lonely.
Backstreet Boys.